TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The End of Water as We Know It, with Argonne National Lab scientist Dr. Seth Darling. Here's the conclusion of a one-hour talk by Dr. Seth Darling. In part one, he spoke about water embedded in certain products that export huge amounts of local water via global trade. And he made an interesting connection between energy production and water. In a time of rising water scarcity, he pointed to economic projections that water demand will rise by at least 55% by 2050. In this part, Dr. Seth Darling is turning to science, describing the amazing characteristics of water as well as its global history. I also included a few of the questions that he answered at the end of his talk. Here is Dr. Seth Darling.
Okay, so you came to hear some science. What is water? H2O, it's the one molecule everybody knows. But maybe there's something you didn't know about water. So this is what the molecule looks like. The O, oxygen, is the red guy in the middle, and the H, the two hydrogens, are on the two sides. What's important about this molecule is the way it's shaped. Those two hydrogen atoms are not in a straight line with the oxygen, with one on each side. They're both on the same side, like Mickey Mouse ears. And that's a really important thing about water, because oxygen likes negative charge more than the hydrogen does. And so the electrons that are flying around that molecule distribute themselves asymmetrically. There's more electrons on one side than on the other side. And so you get something called polarity, where the molecule is more positive over here and more negative over here. And that one aspect of water, the fact that it's polar, controls so many of the things, the interesting and important properties about water. For one thing, that's what allows microwave ovens to work. Microwaves come through and they cause those polar molecules to rotate and vibrate around, and that's what heats up your food. More importantly, water's polarity is what drives proteins to fold. So the proteins that make up you and me and every living thing on Earth are folded up in very complex ways, these big molecules, and all of those folding interactions are mediated by water. If it were not polar, this would not happen. There would be no life. Another strange thing about water's polarity is that it causes solid water, ice, to be less dense than liquid water, water. That is really unusual for a material. There are only a handful of examples of all the materials in the world that we know of where this is true, and water is one of them. That's why ice floats in your glass of water, because it's less dense than the water. And the same thing happens on Lake Michigan in the winter. This is important, that when it freezes in the winter, that ice sits on the top because it's less dense, and that serves as an insulating barrier to keep the entire lake from freezing during the winter, so you can have life in that water year-round. Again, without that, we might not have life on Earth at all. Another thing about water's polarity is that it makes it a fantastic solvent. Polar molecules are really good at dissolving stuff. So you can put all kinds of different things into water and it'll stay there. And that is also really important for us. There are thousands and thousands, probably millions, of different chemicals inside us, going through all kinds of different chemical reactions all the time inside our cells. And all of them are dissolved in water. That's the solvent. So all of those things need to be dissolved by just one thing. But the fact that it's a great solvent has an unfortunate side effect, which means it's very easy to pollute. It can dissolve the stuff we want, but it also dissolves all kinds of stuff you don't want to stay in the water. Heavy metals, you know, all those micropollutants I was talking about, and plenty of other things. Once they get in the water, they stay in the water. Okay, a good news piece of water is that you can't use up water. The water that's on Earth has been here since long before we were here, and it'll be here long after we're all gone. There are still competing theories about where all the water came from originally on Earth. Extraterrestrial sources are recognized as probably one of the significant original sources, but that all happened way early in our planet's history, and that water just keeps going around through a cycle, right? You learned about this in grade school, where water evaporates and then it rains down, and it just keeps going through a cycle. So it's the same water. What that means is that every molecule of water in every glass that you drink has at some point in its life been inside an oak tree, it's been blasted out by a volcano, and it's been urinated by a dinosaur. Which sounds gross. What that actually tells you is another important thing about water, which is that no matter how dirty you make it, it can always be cleaned again. So, clean water. What does that mean to say water is clean? That's actually a really complicated question because, as I said, you can put all kinds of different things into water. And you might say, well, let's just take it all out. So all that's left is H2O. You don't want that. You don't want to drink that. That's actually poison, pure, pure water. It'll leach out nutrients from your body. The point is, you want the water to be the appropriate cleanliness for the application that it's going to be used. If you're going to drink it, you want it to be pretty clean. You don't want viruses or heavy metals or certain things in there. But you do need some minerals to be in there, like I said, so it's actually not unhealthy to drink. There are other things where the water can be dirtier. If you're just going to water your lawn, it doesn't need to be drinking water quality. Or, on the flip side, if you're going to manufacture semiconductors, like what's inside your smartphones and laptops and all that, you do need that water to be ultra, ultra clean, cleaner than drinking water. In fact, much cleaner than drinking water. So, in fact, the most state-of-the-art water purification plants in the world are at semiconductor manufacturing. So the idea here is you make the right water for the right purpose. It's called fit for use. And again, the ancient Romans did this a long time ago. It's time to start doing it again. So how do you clean water? There are lots of ways to clean water. This is just a few examples. There are more. So one way is you can do media filtration. This is an old school technique. You basically have a big barrel of sand, and you just pour your dirty water over the top and let it come out the bottom. And it's not the sand per se that's doing the cleaning. On the sand grows a biofilm with lots of little bacteria and stuff in it that chew up all the, not all, but a lot of the bad stuff that's in the water. So as it percolates through, it gets cleaned up. What happens in most of our municipal plants is coagulation, flocculation, sedimentation, filtration, which I won't go through the time to describe what that whole process is, but that's how most of our municipal water gets cleaned. Under your kitchen sink, you might have membrane filtration. And in fact, that's an area where most of the exciting research, at least in my view, in water technology is these days, is in membrane filtration. I think there are great opportunities to push that technology forward. Other techniques that are out there are things like distillation. This is where you basically boil the water and then recondense it, and then it comes out much cleaner than it was before and leaves behind all the impurities. And you can also disinfect water just to get rid of the pathogens. You can do that with chlorination, dumping in chlorine. That's what we do in most of our municipal systems. You can also do it with ultraviolet light, which in some places in the developing world is also used in municipal water treatment systems. This brings me back to the issue of our oceans. I told you we don't have a water shortage. It's just that most of it is in the oceans. So we do know how to take seawater and make fresh water. It's a process called desalination, and it's come a long way. People have gotten pretty good at desalination. But I want to give you a sense for the scale of the problem here. Every year, the capacity grows. We're building more and more desalination plants, so that's great. And it's maybe not surprising the countries that are leading the way here are places like Israel and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and places that are near salt water and are very dry. But let me tell you the scale of the problem here. You can see how far we have to go if we're going to try and use this to solve our problem. That's not going to get us out of this mess anytime soon. An awful long way to go. Okay. So you may not realize, but here in Chicagoland, we actually have a long history of very impressive water engineering. Long time ago, if you walked out on the streets of Chicago back in the 1800s, it was a really gross place to be. There was sewage on the streets, horse manure and so on. It was awful. And, you know, for a city aspiring to be a growing metropolitan center, that was not acceptable. So the idea would be water sanitation. You want to put that sewage into sewer lines instead of just out on the street. The problem with Chicago is that because of the soil conditions, you couldn't dig under the buildings and put in sewer lines. It wasn't feasible. So what did Ellis Chesbrough do? he thought, well, I'm going to give Chicago the first sewer system in the United States. No city had it before this. And crazy thought, he said, all right, we can't go under the city. Let's lift up the city. And that's actually what they did. They put jacks under all the buildings and jacked them up and built the sewers underneath. Unbelievable. But they did it, and it worked. That solved one problem, because now the sewage wasn't on the streets anymore. But you know where those sewers dumped? Into the Chicago River. Where did the Chicago River go? Into Lake Michigan. That's where our drinking water was coming from. Still is coming from. So we were just dumping raw sewage into our drinking water, and people started getting sick. So you might think, well, let's just dump our sewage somewhere else, but no, not in Chicago. They said, we're just going to make the Chicago River go the other way. And that's what they did. They actually came in and reversed the flow of the Chicago River, dumped a lot of that nasty stuff into what's now the Sanitarium Ship Canal, which actually runs right by Argonne National Laboratory, and, you know, solved the problem, so to speak. But our great water engineering didn't stop there. There's a more recent example at an even larger scale, I would say. So we have this other problem in Chicago that our sewer system is called a combined system, where we use the same lines to handle what comes out of our house as waste and what goes down the storm drains. So for those who've lived in Chicago a long time, you're familiar with when there's a big storm, you get too much water going into that system for the treatment plant to handle, and the whole thing backs up and it comes up in your basement as untreated sewage. So enough taxpayers finally got fed up with this that they created what you've probably heard of as the deep tunnel. Although maybe you've never seen pictures of it. The official name for it is the Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, or TARP plan. But there's this network of tunnels that are massive. And there's a whole bunch of these things under our city which handle this massive flow when there's a big storm that the treatment plant can't handle as fast as it's coming in. And all those tunnels then dump out into places like this. This is Thornton Quarry. This is the largest such reservoir in the world, I believe. So all that water gets tunneled down, dumped into there, and it'll sit there until the treatment plants can catch up and process all that mess and get you back to the normal state of affairs. So we've been thinking about big-scale water engineering in Chicago essentially as long as there's been a Chicago. Let me bring it home a little more, though, to Argonne. There is a sizable but rapidly growing program in water research at Argonne, which very much is in partnership with the University of Chicago, in fact, principally through the Institute for Molecular Engineering, which is a joint institute between these two great research organizations. So just a few examples of the sort of types of work that are going on in water. One would be, I told you a little earlier about how important policy is, things like virtual water not being policed really at all today. The policymakers need to have the right information to understand what policies to put into place, and that's something that smart scientists and engineers can provide. We're also looking at connections between water and the environment in many ways, and food. So top three challenges we face as a society are energy, water, and food. And they're all connected with each other. It's not just a water-energy nexus, it's a water-energy-food nexus. So you guys answered correctly about where most of our water is used, not withdrawn. Most of it's withdrawn for the power plants, but most of it is used for agriculture. If you're going to try and save some water, that's a good place to turn. And we're not very smart about the way we water our crops. We basically just dump water across an entire farm, more or less the same. What you can do instead is something called site-specific crop management, or precision agriculture, where you go in and you deliver just the right amount of water to even each plant, and just at the right spot by its roots. The Israelis are really good at this already. Another interesting topic of research at Argonne is groundwater dating. So I told you earlier about groundwater and fossil water, and how a lot of it's been down there for a really long time. How do you know how long that water's been down there to know how quickly an aquifer is getting replenished? It's actually a really hard question to answer. So the way that we're trained in school that you date old things is carbon dating, right? That's what's used for old human artifacts. Carbon dating doesn't work for things that are hundreds of thousands or even millions of years old. You need some other technique. And so at Argonne, they've developed something called atom trap trace analysis to use krypton dating, and they've actually gone and started dating different aquifers, and they can tell you this one is, 600,000 years old, and that one is 200,000 years old. Really important information. We're also developing all kinds of advanced materials technologies to tackle problems of pollution. In my own group, we're doing things to, for example, clean up oil spills with some advanced materials and developing, I told you, membranes are where most of the exciting new water technology is coming. We're developing all kinds of advanced membrane technologies at Argonne that clean themselves and effectively filter out pathogens and all kinds of other things. Okay, so we face a lot of huge societal challenges. There's climate change, there's income inequality in our financial system, and so on and so forth. A lot of these big challenges, it's really hard to muster affection for them. The financial system, maybe the University of Chicago is the wrong place to say this, but it's really hard to muster affection about the financial system. But our affection for water is something that we're born with. We are all so connected to water, people love water. It is who we are, literally. And water's invisibility, I said, is bad for us and for water. The fact that we have this innate affection for it is good for us and for water. And we need to start reevaluating water's importance. It's important for our foreign policy, our food, the environment around us, public health, our national security, and as I told you, it's intimately connected to energy. It connects to our lives in so many different ways. So water may be invisible, but I would encourage you to start seeing water. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I was aware of the technology of desalination, but I'm concerned. How is that economically feasible? And what do you think about the future to make it more economically feasible for poor countries in Africa and South Asia?
Okay, desalination. I mentioned one thing is that we've got a long way to go with it in terms of scale, right? So it's very important in places like Israel, for example, but globally, the scale is essentially irrelevant at this point. So let me talk about technology and science first with desalination. So you can calculate by the laws of physics, thermodynamics, how much energy it takes to take the salt out of seawater to give you drinking water. It's some amount of energy. And it used to be, you know, a few decades ago, that the desalination technology was a long way away from that limit. When they would use, there are still plants operating in places like Saudi Arabia that essentially do distillation. It's very energy intensive. But the state-of-the-art plants, reverse osmosis plants, which is what people are building today, are so good that they're actually approaching those fundamental limits and how efficient it could ever be. So there's actually no breakthrough coming in, you know, energy savings for desalination. And by the way, that is what limits how much you can desalinate. You talk about the cost. That's where the cost is primarily, is in the energy to build up the pressure to shove the salt water through those membranes and get the salt out. And energy just costs money. So there's no breakthrough coming there. It's never going to get a lot cheaper than it is today. It'll get a little bit cheaper as people get a little better at it, but there's no breakthrough there. What I just said is true for seawater, but the story changes for brackish water, which is less salty water, and there's a lot of brackish water on Earth in aquifers, for example. Many places where there's fossil fuels, there's also water, but the water's a little salty. Not as salty as seawater, but it's too salty to drink. And desalinating that, there's all kinds of exciting technological innovations that are yet to be made. There's all kinds of room for improvement there. So don't give up on desalination altogether. I'm just saying there's not a breakthrough in seawater desalination. In terms of cost, the Israelis pay more for water than we do because it's expensive to desalinate because of the energy. And there's really no way around that. What I would argue, though, is we're not actually paying as much for water here as we should be. There's not really intelligent water pricing much of anywhere on Earth today, which I tried to allude to a few times. That will help us start making smarter decisions with how we use water if it has an appropriate price on it. The flip side of that is you can argue that water is a human right. You can't charge people for water if they can't afford to buy enough to live. That's inhuman. And so how do you balance those two things? And there's another issue. So, you know, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, University of Chicago, we can talk about this, that, you know, uses market forces to try and solve your problem. So you come up with a price, and you say that's the price, and then let the market solve your problem. But all that does is make sure that we humans share our water in a certain way that maybe makes sense. The problem is we're not the only ones who need water. The ecosystem around us needs water, too. The rest of the Earth needs a lot of water to grow the trees and all the other things that happen on Earth that need water, all the other organisms, and they don't pay water bills. So there has to be another hand that comes in with Adam Smith's invisible hand, a green hand, if you will, that represents the, you know, the Lorax, speaks for the trees.
You had fracking in your discussion. Can you address two issues here? One, you're talking about a shortage of water. My understanding of fracking is you're taking water, polluting it, dumping it down into the ground, therefore making our short supply of water even less.
Yep.
Second, what about fracking? What do you see is the probability that some of this water going down into the fracking area is going to contaminate the groundwater that you're talking about?
So people are just starting to study that, and I think there are mixed reports. I suspect it totally depends on the local geology, what the answer to that question is. I think there are places where it doesn't end up getting into the aquifers, and there are places where it does. And so we just need to be a lot smarter and figure that all out before we start doing all those operations, which we're not doing today. And you're right, those types of operations in general, fossil fuel operations, are very water intensive. And also they produce a lot of water. It's called produced and flowback water that comes back up with the fossil fuels, and that water is dirty. It's got salt and hydrocarbons and heavy metals and other junk in it that was down there under the ground. And what do you do with all that water? And right now what they're usually doing is they're just dumping it into a holding pond, in many cases, which are not even lined, and so then it just goes back down and might get into aquifers. So yeah, there's all kinds of challenges there that are going to need to be addressed.
You talked a little bit about climate change, its impact on water. Is there any way to really quantify how much of an impact climate change could have on the cost of water?
I don't think the cost of water is ever going to go down, and probably nor should it. Quantify the effect is a really hard thing to do, and especially because there's so many ways in which climate and water are interrelated. I mentioned drought, I mentioned melting of glaciers. Also, sea level rise is pushing salt water into freshwater aquifers, so it's polluting those sources. Precipitation changes, extreme weather events are changing the way we interact with water. There are countless examples of interconnections between climate disruption and water, none of which I can think of that are good.
I have a question that goes back to the idea that we live next to this great body of fresh water. I've also seen maps that show that the aquifers and the groundwater depletion in the Chicago and Milwaukee region is something like 900 feet, which is greater than some areas of the Southwest. So is it almost like a false sense of security that we have the lake next to us if what we're doing is we're depleting the groundwater to that extent?
Yeah, it's true the water table is falling almost everywhere. And so when people drill wells, they have to keep drilling them deeper and deeper because that groundwater just keeps getting lower and lower as it gets drained. And yes, that is true in places where there's a lot of surface water too, like here in the upper Midwest, but it's especially true in places where that's the primary source of water and it's just disappearing frighteningly fast. So yes, we need to take responsibility for our water use even though we are comparatively water rich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Darling. As a nanoscientist, according to your biographical information, are there any revolutionary molecular nano-level prospects that you are working on?
So one example, pathogens in water are a huge problem. That's why every 90 seconds a child dies somewhere in the world. The way that we get rid of pathogens today is usually by dumping chlorine in the water. And that causes all kinds of problems. One of the things it causes is it creates other toxic compounds, which we go through a lot of troubles in our water systems to try and take care of, because that chlorine reacts with various organic compounds and creates all kinds of nasty carcinogenic junk. It's also, chlorinated water can't be put through a reverse osmosis system. It damages the membranes, so you have to take out the chlorine and then put it back in later in the system. So it's not a good solution, and it's not a solution that's available anyway in many parts of the developing world. What would be nice is if you could just filter out those pathogens. Now, we have filters that can do that, like a reverse osmosis filter. A reverse osmosis filter is basically non-porous. Think of it as just a sheet of plastic. And you shove the heck out of that water, it'll go through there, and nothing else except the water will go through there. And so that'll work, but you need an enormous amount of energy to do that. It's overkill to remove pathogens, which are much bigger than something like salt ions, which is what reverse osmosis is really good at taking out. What you'd like is a filter that had pores in it that were just a little bit smaller than maybe those viruses or cryptosporidium or whatever your parasite or pathogen is, so that it can't go through, but the water can easily go through those comparatively. For a water molecule, a pore like that would be huge. Okay, those filters are called ultrafiltration or nanofiltration filters. That's sort of the length scale of things like viruses. They're kind of tens of nanometers in scale. There are no good commercial ultrafiltration membranes to filter out all of the pathogens. What you really want is a membrane where all the pores are the same size and just the right size so that you can easily push water through and you filter out all the pathogens. We were trying to do that using a technique called self-assembly. There are these polymers that organize themselves into structures that are right on that length scale. You can try and build membranes out of those things. We use other technology we've developed at Argon to make those things be chemically inert and thermally stable and all the other things mechanically robust that you want in a membrane so that we can effectively filter out pathogens.
You mentioned every 90 seconds a child dies because of not having access to clean drinkable water. And you also mentioned that having access to clean water is a human right. I noticed you mentioned the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One portion of it is because of water. What are your thoughts on Israel cutting off the water supply to the Palestinians, and how is this in compliance with human rights and international law?
Yeah, so we're, again, stepping well outside my area of expertise. A general statement, not to that particular geopolitical situation, is that I do believe water on some level is a human right. This is why we can't just simply throw a price on water and expect that to solve everything, because there are plenty of people living in poverty who just wouldn't be able to afford to live. Everybody needs water. It's one of those few things that you just cannot live without. And so it should not be used as a weapon of war, which, by the way, water has been used as a weapon since humans have been around. You know, sieges on ancient castles, they would dump poisonous stuff into the river that was going into the castle, things like that. I mean, water's been used in war as long as there have been humans. Humans are just awful to each other, and water's so important. If you're going to try and hurt people, that's an effective way to hurt people, which we shouldn't do. Sorry, I think we'll need to stop there.
You heard the end of a one-hour talk with Q&A by Dr. Seth Darling, entitled The End of Water as We Know It. Seth Darling is a scientist at Argonne National Lab and a fellow at the Institute for Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago. He's the co-author with Douglas Sisterson of the 2014 book, How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate. He spoke at the International House, University of Chicago, and was recorded by Dale Lehman on May 18, 2016. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.